it's something that we live our lives within, but don't think very much about unless we're in the profession. A good broad definition of landscape architecture is that is the art and practice of designing the outdoor environment. That includes the obvious parks and gardens, but it also includes spaces such as cemeteries, campuses, city centers, and even suburbs. Because gardening is such a popular, I think it is the number one hobby in the United States.
How about that?
Yes. A lot of people have a connection to this art form, but many people think of it largely in terms of plants. In fact, on the broader scale, it also involves roads. It can involve changing the course of rivers. It can involve buildings, sculpture, and planting of trees, realignment of paths. Landscape architects pay attention to all kinds of forces in nature, not just plants, such as the trajectory of the sun, the play of shadows across a lawn, even the sound of a brook in a park.
Hearing you talk about that, Robin, just puts me in the mindset of like a really fine waiter, in that you know, if they're doing their job correctly, you're really enjoying yourself or feeling something, and yet you're just not aware they're there. You're in a place and time in a location, and if it's landscaped well or designed well, it really does enrich your experience.
I think that's absolutely true. And a great example of that, and one that many people know, is Central Park, which has become a mecca for people all over the world because the experience of being in that place is so enriching. And in fact, most people, without thinking about it, assume that what was there? It's the part of the city that didn't get built up. They don't realize what a work of artifice it is, how Olmsted carried in or had carried in tons and tons of rock to build those outcroppings in the Ramble. He drained the swamps, dug lakes, created a very imaginative road system in order to sink the transit roads that run from one side of the city to the other down below grade so you wouldn't be aware of the traffic sounds. Many, many innovations like that, and much of the landscape architecture in this country, and this is one of the themes in my book and in the exhibition at Rimolda House, much of the landscape architecture of this country derives its force and its spirit from Olmsted's ideas.
You're talking about Frederick Law Olmsted, and I'm wondering if you could put him in perspective. I'm struck by the appreciation then versus now for this sort of art, and thinking that Frederick Law Olmsted was really a rock star of sorts in his day. Could you put him in perspective? I mean, he was a giant.
He was a giant, and it would take several radio programs to do him justice. His contribution to the new art of landscape architecture, and he was the first person to identify himself that way, is enormous. He really did found the modern profession by establishing a very important office. It changed over years. It had different partners, including his son and his stepson. He ran it by diversifying the work within the office, by hiring specialists in different aspects of the art to coordinate and execute those aspects, from planting, for example, to engineering, but all combined to create a singular vision. His other great philosophical contribution was to teach others to pay attention to the spirit of the place, to respond to the cues that were there. Some of those are tangible, like a lake or a marsh or a beautiful view, and some of them are intangible. It's just a sense, a spirit, but to let that spirit guide the design so that it's not warring with the underlying sense of place that gives each place its distinction and its charm.
I can't remember the title of the book. Was it The Devil in the White City?
That was a, yes.
Yeah, yes. That book on so many levels gripped me, but much of it was the description of, well, first off, the undertaking of converting that Chicago Lakeshore area into this beautiful city, but also that impact. And that really did go on to influence a whole generation of the wealthy, the elite in this country in terms of their approach to developing landscapes. Did that spill into then your recent look at a country place era? Could you trace that for us?
There is a connection. The World's Columbian Exposition of 1893 was a turning point in American consciousness. This country saw itself for the first time as really playing on a world stage, economically, culturally, and artistically. 22 million people visited Chicago over the course of those 2 years, and they came away with a sense of what was possible. And those ideas transformed cities across the nation. New cities, young cities, and even old cities. It also transformed the sense of what could be done on a private estate. And of course, that was a time of enormous wealth, especially before 1913, when income tax was implemented. People saw great potential in these pieces of property they were buying, mainly outside city hubs. And they saw that there was a new profession training people to create the same kind of magic that they saw in Chicago. Some of this magic derived from combining many different cultural influences, almost like a around the world in 80 days kind of feeling, you know, a bit of England here and France there and a touch of the East. And, of course, people were traveling more to bring home memories from these wonderful grand tours they were taking, real citations from gardens and sometimes adaptations of things they'd seen abroad, literally in their own backyards.
The image came to me of living postcards. I mean, they really were kind of reliving those experiences with real design elements and real plants.
Exactly. It was working another way, too, having a European-influenced garden was culturally legitimizing. It made people feel important. And there was a lot of status and jostling for prominence involved here. And in some cases, these properties were outlandish in their scope and in the combinations of influences that were being tried. I think the very best designers of the era were the most grounded in this Olmstedian sense of place, a response to the genius of the place.
Where does, of course, we're talking in Biltmore country here, a little east of there, but where does that fall in the spectrum in your eyes?
In my eyes, it's at the very beginning of the period that I attempted to write about. I didn't include Biltmore because it was really the stimulus for so much that came after, as opposed to one of this, I think of this as an art movement, like Impressionism or Expressionism, and I think it really got going in the years just after Biltmore, which was by far the largest private estate that Olmsted undertook, and in some ways so large, it doesn't even make sense to compare it. I mean, it was hundreds of thousands of acres and a village and a school of forestry. The seven properties that I write about in A Genius for Place cohere as works of art, as individual works of art, much like paintings or pieces of music. And that was one of the criteria I looked for in selecting them.
Yeah, I can certainly see how this lends itself so well to photography, because just to get the scope of it, I can't think of any other medium that would really be able to do that. Could you kind of outline for listeners how Carol went about photographing the gardens and really bringing them to life for viewers?
Yes. Carol brings an extraordinary ability to capture the spirit of a place through image. It's kind of magical. I don't know how she does it. She photographs space, not so much objects in space, but the way space works. For example, a lawn, a meadow edged by trees, or the glint of sunlight on a pool. We work together. In writing the book, came up with the major ideas that had guided the design by looking at the correspondence between clients and designers, looking at, in some cases, designers' own writings about these places, and wrote these chapters in order to uncover those ideas, and then talked with Carol about those ideas when we were in the landscapes together. And she very consciously tried to capture what those specific ideas were in taking her shots. Each garden provided many more images than we could include in the exhibition. Each is represented by 10 shots, and I'm sure we ended up with more like 50. It was hard to decide what to choose, but we wanted to only include images that showed not exactly the original design. That's impossible because landscapes are always changing, but as close as we could get to the original design. So we weren't photographing later additions or things that were much changed, and gardens do change, of course. Ownership changes, and new owners want new things. So we carefully looked at the old plans, and in many cases, the old photographs, to make our selections.
The images I'm seeing online are in black and white. Are they color images, a combination?
There are color images, one for each site. We decided to, rather than to mix them, in a way, a black and white photograph is more evocative than a color. A color is more modern. It brings it into the present very sharply. So what we did is chose one color shot for each garden and had it printed very large with vegetable-based ink. So it has a real painterly quality to it. And each one, what I was going for was a kind of dreamlike sense, something that set the scene. And then you could feel almost as though you were traveling back in time through these beautiful black and white pictures.
It transports you in a way that really nothing else can.
I agree with that. It's a powerful art form. It's very deeply stirring, and I think it's because you're sensing time. I mean, you're moving through the space and time, but you're also in touch with all the centuries that came before. Of course, that was a great challenge in these new gardens in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s, how to approach that feeling of antiquity in something that was very new.
I found that interesting, too. You explore this issue of the influence of French modernism, and after coming on the heels of reading David McCullough's book, Americans in Paris, in the 1830s, and now we jump ahead 100 years, and once again, Paris is front and center.
Yes. It really sparked, in Fletcher Steele in particular, one of the landscape architects in my survey, it sparked an avalanche of ideas about what gardens could be if they broke loose from their traditional moorings. He was already headed in that direction, but there were a series of very interesting modernist gardens that had the Paris Exposition of 1925, where people were using concrete trees and revolving globes covered with mirrors and colored plants in wild patterns, and also exploring space in the garden, exploring the garden very specifically as a three-dimensional place rather than the way many people tend to think of gardens or, you know, plants on the ground.
Did any of the Art Deco elements of the 20s find their way into this sort of architecture?
Yes. The most famous example is Steele's own work at Naumkeag, which is a garden he designed in the Berkshires for Mabel Choate beginning in 1926. He was actually working on top of a 1885 garden, respecting many of its lines and its general layout. But his most whimsical and, in a way, most powerful at the same time feature for that project is called the Blue Steps. And that's very clearly influenced by Art Deco, Art Deco rhythms. It's a wonderful water staircase that comes down the side of the hill very sharply. And many people now know it as an iconic image from American landscape history. And that's kind of neat that people are really thinking about this as an art form and able to actually recognize places, and the field is assuming a kind of a form that it didn't have even 10 years ago.
Well, I'm off in dreamland now. Thank you for the way you spell that. It just seems so crystal clear. You referenced in broad terms that there were seven distinct locations you're focusing in on, but would you like to maybe spell out another from that group?
Yes. I think the best known of the seven gardens, probably the most heavily visited, is Winterthur in Delaware. And that is, like Rinalda, a very ambitious, not utopian, but certainly a progressive combination of a farm and a village and a very, very beautiful garden. Harry DuPont, the owner of Winterthur, worked closely with Marion Coffin on many aspects of the place and actually did some on his own. And he was a great plantsman. So that is kind of a mecca, not as much for design, but for its marvelous collection of plants, and I think that's a good place for people to start because most people do have the experience of going to the nursery and buying plants and putting them in the ground, and that's where their own experience and high art of landscape architecture intersect.
This is David's selfish question time, but do we have landscape architects and artists to thank for plants like, and this is from the nostalgia end, maybe they came back from Australia, we've got eucalyptus, we've got kudzu, we've got several East Asian plants that are now invasive species. Can we thank that leg of our landscape architecture for those new species we may not want to have around?
I think you can. Unfortunately,
boo.
In many cases, they were not aware of the resilience of these plants, and they planted bittersweet and multiflora rose without having any idea what the ultimate consequences would be. I should say at the same time that there were many landscape architects who were firmly grounded in their advocacy for Native American plants. And countries around the world, including England, which is, of course, known for its gardens, were envious of the remarkable plant palette American landscape architects had to work with. I mean, there's nothing like an American elm.